morning. You're listening to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9 FM. I'm your host and creative director, Stephen Lampke, and my very special guest today is Matthias Kalm of The Burning Hell. Hello, Matthias.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm having a wonderful day so far.
Are you?
Yes, it's the best.
It's the best.
The best day.
Thank you for joining us on this best day. It's a very beautiful day here in Sackville. It's warm, it's sunny, it's clear. Where are we calling you today?
You're calling me just across the water on Prince Edward Island at my place out in Fairfield. And this is kind of, I mean, we're probably having a similar weather experience right now. And I think this is the second day of summer officially, right? Or is it the first? I don't know. Anyway, it really feels like it. And I've been out gardening and running around having a good time. And yeah, I was supposed to be at the mechanics today, but then that got rescheduled. So I'm really happy about that. Yeah, I've been planting blueberries. I've been having a great time.
You're planting blueberries?
Yeah.
Oh,
I caught like a bunch of our blueberry bushes got pretty decimated in some early frosts. And so I was at the superstore the other day and they had all these like end of season for some people, but they had all these deals on blueberries. So I got a couple more plants and I'm trying to fill out our blueberry patch.
I'm living in a house kind of at the edge of Sackville this summer, and I'm also trying my hand at gardening, and for me it's basically the first time I've ever really done anything like that other than plants, you know, some herbs and in small boxes.
Are you having a good time?
I got a little bit enthusiastic, and the vernacular wisdom around here is to not plant before the 1st of June, or even the first full moon in June, which this year is, I don't think it's even happened yet. It's
great. Right.
I covered some stuff up one night where we had frost, but there was we had a warm patch and some things grew fairly well, and then it completely plateaued for like 3 or 4 weeks. But now the little green things seem to be growing again.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time. This is also basically my first year of like full tilt gardening ever in my life. I've always been interested in it, but I've never had, I've only like lived out here in the countryside for the last couple of years, and we've been mostly just renovating the house. So this is my first chance to really go crazy with the landscaping, and it's so much fun. I'm having the best time.
Are blueberries the kind of thing that... I'm guessing, but I would imagine it's maybe like a thing that you would plant and then it would be a year or two or more maybe before really much happens in terms of harvesting.
Yeah, I'm not really sure to be honest. I definitely was hoping that we'd have a little bit more action this year, but yeah, like the early frosts got them pretty bad. They're still alive, but they're tiny now. They're like miniature dwarf blueberry plants now. So I think it's going to be a couple of years before they get really established for sure.
Well, at the risk of turning this into a gardening show led by two people that
let's take some calls. Let's
that,
take some calls.
I know very little about, yeah, about gardening. Perhaps we'll transition into a discussion, and I will try to do this in a way that does tie it in by saying that one of the things that's appealing to me about gardening and planting seeds or seedlings or plants is you are assuming a future, and you're assuming that natural cycles will operate in the way that they're meant to, and growth will happen.
Definitely, that's the assumption. I think I see where you're going with this. It's a great segue.
Okay, thank you. You relatively recently put out an album, Revival Beach, as the,
yes,
Burning Hell. I guess it came out late last year. It's still your newest Burning Hell album, I believe.
Yep.
And it is focused thematically around the apocalypse.
Yeah, more or less.
More,
yeah,
or less. Okay. I'm simplifying, and I'm also obviously interpreting. So to try and phrase this maybe into a long-winded question, I feel like we're living in very anxious times, and everybody I know is basically, you know, suffering through feelings of hopelessness or trying to maintain hope and or sort of belief in the continuation of things that we agree are good. And I would say that maybe the dominant sort of feelings that we see in the world are rage and anxiety in it. And you've made an album about, at least in part, about the apocalypse and about sort of the endings. And it's not a rageful or anxious sounding album.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that, because I think to me it is, compared to the other records I've done. But no, I mean, there's humor in it too, and I try and take a sort of a arm's length view of certain topics, and a kind of obtuse view of certain topics. So I don't know. I mean, part of it for me is that I wanted to respond somehow to all the things that were going on when I was writing those songs. And that was sort of, you know, this is a couple years now, sort of spanning the run up to the last American election and then that election and the immediate aftermath. And since then we've entered like a seemingly a new phase of surrealist, kind of constant apocalypse. So I think I probably should write another album that would be much more anxious. Because when I was writing those songs at first, I thought, you know, at least part of me was still very hopeful that this was, you know, a blip, that everyone would soon see the error of our ways, and then we would start correcting the course a little bit. But that doesn't seem to have happened or be happening all that much, although I guess an optimist might look at it differently. And yeah, things are pretty bleak. I've actually like changed my news consumption habits pretty radically since for the last 3 or 4 months, just because I was going into a pretty downward spiral, with, you know, reading as much of the news as I was used to doing. And yeah, things are, it's bad. It's really bad. Oh my gosh. But yeah, the record Revival Beach is, it tries to personalize the experience of the apocalypse, I guess, and come at it from a bunch of different angles. So, and not just imagining an apocalyptic event like a nuclear war or a plague or something like that, but more sort of interpreting the apocalypse as something happening more or less constantly in different ways. You know, whether it's environmental degradation or police brutality. You know, we are experiencing sort of apocalyptic times, I think, in a lot of ways, that maybe aren't as dramatic as we've imagined them in Hollywood or literature or whatever. So, yeah, that's a long-winded answer, I think, to what you're getting at. But
I think, like, when, I mean, I've had conversations like this many times, and there's the idea that, oh, things will get bad, or things can get better by things first getting bad, and that can be like a push towards an overall like ultimate improvement. And I heard people say this around the, you know, election of Trump or in Canada, like perhaps around our own elections and stuff. And you mentioned a Hollywood sort of mentality, and I just think that's such a Hollywood mentality, that like the narrative is that things get really bad and then all of a sudden things get better.
Yeah.
Like through some sort of individual or collective heroic act. And I just can't believe that I don't think there's much evidence of that being how things actually work in the real world.
Right. And I mean, I think if you take a really simplistic view of history, You can always find examples that prove that theory, but obviously things are a lot more complicated than that. I also think that there's a corollary that really, talking about like making music or art around in times like this, there's a corollary to that sort of, you know, things are going to get bad before they get better or whatever. There's a corollary to that attitude, which is that, you know, bad times produce great art. And I heard that over and over again around the Trump election. And I've heard it ever since, people saying, well, this is just going to be, you know, the one positive thing is that this is going to be like a whole new renaissance of like politically charged art and literature and music. And regardless of whether or not that's true, I think it's, you know, it's a pretty devastating way to look at both the political climate and artistic production, you know, that either A, we need bad times in order to have something interesting to write about, or I don't know. I mean, or is it even actually true? I don't even know. I mean, I've been wrestling with that myself, and I sort of had some trepidation about putting out an album that's definitely the most political. I mean, it's not overtly political, maybe, but it's the most political thing I've ever done musically, and I had a bit of trepidation putting that out in these times because I was thinking, like, well, you know, I don't want. This isn't the sum total of my response to what's going on here. You know, I have a lot more to say and a lot more to think about this, and I hope other people do too. But I don't believe it's true that things have to get bad before they get better. I think that's kind of defeatist, and I think it also excuses a lot of apathy for us to be able to just say, well, you know, next election. I know so many people that keep talking about 2020, you know, well, in 2020, everything's going to change. And in terms of American politics, at least, and I don't have that much faith that the pendulum has swung so far to to the right that then there's going to be this natural pushback against it that's going to actually result in political change. I think that we might be, unfortunately disappointed, by what happens then. Anyway, yeah. But yeah, I know what you're saying.
I'm curious to maybe follow through on the idea about bad times making good art. The supposition there is that the only sort of social engagement that art can have is one of protest.
Yeah.
And I don't think you write protest songs. And I think you make great art, you know, and that is engaged with the world. And I'm curious, like, how you think about your own work as a public practice.
Ooh, that's a big question.
I'm trying to ask the big questions, you know.
Can we talk about blueberries?
Well, we can, of course.
It's a good question. It's an important question for me to think through. First of all, I wish that I've tried to write protest songs, and I wish I could do it. I wish that I could write the kind of, the kind of politically charged sort of anthemic songs that might actually have a chance of making a difference in the world, or at least in someone's life or whatever. But I've tried to do it too many times, and it always comes out sounding insincere. I think that there's some songwriters that can find that tone in writing a political song without being preachy, whilst being engaging and all that kind of stuff. I've always wanted to write a protest song and never been able to. On the other hand, I see that there's a really pretty consistent, at least in terms of the songwriters that I like, there's a pretty consistent tendency to try and engage with an experience of the world around us. And whether that's has a lot of depth or there's humor in it or whatever, I think that a lot of songwriters are in the same position as me, or we sort of, you know, we are trying to touch on things that are happening around us, and things that we're involved in, and things that we see. While, you know, on the one hand, staying true to our own voice, and on the other hand, making the song sort of understandable and accessible to a wider audience. And it's really tricky. It's super tricky. And I'm not sure that I was at all successful with Revival Beach. But it was a nice experiment for me to try and be more conscious about it and try and be more more dedicated to the idea that I can do this, that I can write sort of more politically and socially engaged songs, and they won't just be sort of trite or preachy or whatever. So yeah, tricky.
I realize. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you're a songwriter that I think you're sort of continually engaging with the world in your songs, and often in a very sort of tactile and personal way in your lyrics. But, you know, you managed to sort of, I don't know, you managed just to do exactly what I was saying I've always aspired to do, to engage with that experience of the world and have, you know, retain your own voice very, very strongly. But write things that manage to connect with people. It's a talent for sure, and it's a goal I aspire to kind of constantly.
I mean, I would say in my own work, I've realized that a lot of the writing for me is responsive to the world. Like, and I've never really believed in that idea of the artist as a monk, you know, up on the mountaintop, not engaging with anything beyond their own sort of physical boundaries.
Yeah.
Like very, very constrained physical boundaries. And I know that that is something that other people do believe in, but that's not been of interest or, it hasn't been a model for me at all. So when I recognize that for me, the art making is actually like a active response that just, you know, welcomes in everything from growing blueberries to being upset about political decisions that, you know, elected officials might make, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it. I mean, I can't even think of one person I know that's, you know, making music or painting or sculpting or anything who isn't, you know, we're all engaged with the world in one way or another, and it will, even if we try not, if we actively try not to, you know, let that influence what we're making, it will, it should, you know, not kind of naturally. So, yeah.
And the other thing, like, I realized sort of midway through this conversation, like, we were referring to Revival Beach, the album, the Burning Hell album, the Revival Beach. But an interesting thing about being a songwriter and a performing songwriter is that, you know, you make these albums, but you in particular are always touring and you're always performing them. And that idea of performance is automatically, and it's an engagement with the time and place that you find yourself singing those songs. And I've had the great pleasure of touring with you and seeing you, you and the Burning Hell perform, you know, for whatever, 20 nights in a row or whatever. And even if the set list might be fairly similar from one night to night to night, as a performer, I've always really looked up to you because you have always seemed incredibly present and engaged with the situation you find yourself in.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's an amazing compliment. I definitely try. I mean, and maybe that's less of a intentional sort of, I think it's less that I'm trying really hard to figure out exactly what will work on a given night, although there is an element to that too, depending on all kinds of factors, the venue, the crowd, the promoter, all sorts of things influence those sorts of how to present a song. But the other thing is that touring for some people I know is a drag, but I've always loved it because it gives me a chance to learn about new places every day and meet new people every day and have new experiences and obviously in the fun kind of superficial ways, but also in more meaningful ways and you know, learning about you get this, it's not like traveling as a regular sort of going on vacation, because you're constantly meeting people, at least one or two people every day who you have some kind of connection with that's not completely superficial, right? So whether that's a promoter or whether someone you're staying with or a band that you share a stage with or whatever, you have all these opportunities to have slightly more meaningful full interactions than you could have otherwise. And that to me is such a gift. And I try really hard not to take that for granted. And I think that naturally kind of affects the way I perform. So I am naturally very interested in what's going on in the local community. Like, what are the local politics all about? You know, like, I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can learn in a few hours in a new place, talking to someone who is interested in sharing their city with you, and that's really wonderful. And I think that will sort of always naturally shape a particular performance, if that's kind of what you're getting at.
I'm just throwing softballs at you, really. And
nice, I love them.
And I'm not trying to get at anything in particular. I'm trying to be present in this conversation in the way that we're describing being present as performers. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's a really funny thing. Like, when you think about it, we don't often think about it very hard, but performing, and this applies across disciplines, I think, performing is, there's always an element of uniqueness and the potential for surprise in any performance, even if it's a show, even if it's like, you know, a piece of musical theater or something, and you're doing it on the same stage that you've done, you know, and the run has been a month long or something like that. There's still always the potential for something new to happen, even if that newness is subtle, and even if those differences aren't really going to be remarked on by maybe the audience or something like that, then you as the performer will know them, you feel them. Everybody who has ever played a set has that experience that, you know, sometimes a song will go great and other times it won't. And there's all sorts of factors that will influence that. Sometimes you'll have the greatest show of your life, and then you'll come back to the same place 2 years later and it'll be the worst show of your life. And you know, things always change. There's so many factors that change, and that's really, although that can be sort of unsettling, I think sometimes, it's also an incredible, incredible opportunity to sort of really throw yourself into a performance, every time.
And when you're writing a new album, or you're writing a new song or batch of songs, how much are you imagining the performance? Like, I'm a songwriter as well. I'm a fan of songwriters, and I've tried to sort of think through like what a song even really is. Many songs are intended to be reenacted and reperformed night after night, and some songs aren't. And when I think about your work, the number of times you must have performed, you know, It Happens in Florida, or Amateur Rappers, or something, you know, it would be a high number, I would imagine. And I wonder, like, I just wonder both, like, if that was anticipated maybe when you were writing those songs, and how that maybe influences the work that you do, you know, currently.
I think with the earliest, it's a great question. I think with the earliest stuff that I wrote, there was never any intention of performing any of it live. The first couple records I did, I wasn't touring. I wasn't thinking of myself as a performer. You know, I would do occasional shows, but really I wasn't thinking about it as something I'd be presenting in front of an audience. So definitely that was not on my radar at the beginning. And then over time it has crept in quite a bit more. And now I think when I write a song, I know almost immediately first of all, it needs to pass the test of, you know, the self-editing test. And if it makes it past that test, then I'll know almost right away whether or not it's a song I'll ever play live. And there's always, for every record, there's always at least a few songs that are supposed to be just on the record and never perform live. And those are actually some of my favorites, as a songwriter, some of the ones I'm most proud of. And the reason that they don't work live, in my limited experience of trying those kinds of songs live, is because they require a sort of close listening that isn't always possible at a concert. in order to be appreciated, I think. They're not catchy. They're often pretty, they're more abstract than some of my other songs. And the songs that work live, by contrast, are, they're often, you know, stories that, and that helps me too as a performer. When there's a story involved, I can get myself into that story, the space of that story again. So for, you know, to be the narrator in a song like Amateur Rappers is very easy for me because, well, first of all, yeah, I've played it hundreds of times, but more to the point, like, I get into that role, the role of that character every time in a little, I mean, it may not even be apparent to anyone else, but for me, it keeps me super engaged, and I'm not just sort of, reciting it. I am most of the time, really, really in it, because I've allowed myself to be kind of taken away by the story. So yeah, I don't know. It's a really interesting thing. And with Revival Beach, the opposite happened for the first time ever, where there were a whole bunch of songs, in fact, probably about half the album, that I was sure, once we had finished recording it all, I was like, there's no way we're going to play any of these. I mean, there's a lot of instrumental songs on the album. We never do instrumentals live. There's a bunch of like very short, very kind of strange songs on the record. I was like, those aren't definitely going to be live. There's like maybe three or four songs I know are going to make it. Like, I mean, B.A. Johnson is a perfect example of someone who knows, like, right away, almost immediately, not only which songs he's going to play live from a record, but which ones are going to go over well, you know? And he knows what works. And so when he goes into recording, I mean, I don't know if you're going to talk to him, but I hope he corrects me if I'm wrong here, but he can sort of pick out right away, like, oh, well, these 15 songs that I'm putting on this album, like, I'll probably never play live. And I was, you know, for the first time ever, taken aback by Revival Beach, because almost all the songs that I thought weren't going to be played live ended up getting done live and have been really fun. I mean, I don't know if anyone else likes them, but I've had a really good time playing them. So it's interesting. Things can change.
And of course, shows are different, and you have such a catalog of material to draw from that certain songs can work in different contexts, and you can pull from them. I was going to comment that I feel like I have seen you perform nearly every song from Revival Beach at some point.
Yeah, I think we have at this point. No, I know we have performed every song at least once. And then, yeah, and some of them that I never ever thought would be interesting to anyone else have become pretty regulars in the set list. So it's fun.
We're about halfway through. I should just remind our listeners who may have tuned in that they're listening to CHMA 106.9 FM. This is Sappy Fest Radio, and my special guest today is Matthias Kalm of The Burning Hell. You are coming back to Sappy Fest this summer, and I think I should have looked this up. I should have done my research, but it's by memory. I'm guessing it's been 6 or so years, maybe? Since you last,
I should have done my research too. I think that's correct. I think maybe it's 5. I think we were there in 2013. No, 2012 was the last time. So yeah, 6 years.
We're thrilled that you're coming back.
I'm very excited. I'm very excited about seeing all the other shows too. You've done an amazing job. The lineup.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. I think it's going to be great. I am curious, you currently live in PEI. I know you've lived in St. John's, Newfoundland. I know you have lived in Peterborough. I know you spent time in Europe and that you've toured Europe extensively and very regularly. And a couple of questions. I'll just throw them all out at the same time.
Sure.
I'm curious where do you belong? Where are you coming from? Both sort of culturally and maybe even geographically, or the intersection of geography and culture. And also, I'm curious what your thoughts are on Canada and why it seems like you haven't been performing in Canada as much as you have been other places.
All right, well, okay, how much time do we have?
We have
a lot to say about both of those things. in terms of where I feel like I belong or where I'm coming from and that kind of thing, I've lived in a lot of different places, and I think that's been a wonderful thing and a bad thing. I grew up in Winnipeg and then in Ontario, and then I've been on the East Coast for a long time now, whether in here or in St. John's. And then Berlin for a few years when I was finishing my my graduate studies. And yeah, and all of that is wonderful because I think moving around a bunch and getting involved in different communities and meeting so many different people has given me a lot of fantastic memories, obviously, but also there's something about it that makes you adaptable, and it makes you, even if your natural inclination is to be sort of shy and possibly introverted, and that is definitely my natural inclination, just having to sort of, settle into a new place so frequently has meant that I think I've worked on that a bit and come a little bit more out of my shell, although I still am quite nervous or shy in any situation usually. But so that's been a really positive thing. The bad thing is that I feel like I don't have the roots in a particular place that a lot of people do. And I've certainly lived in a lot of places where local roots seem to be very important to people. St. John's is the example that really stands out to me. And that kind of sucks, because when you are an outsider in that kind of place, it can feel sort of alienating. St. John's is a wonderful city in so many ways, and I love all of my friends there very dearly. But it can be, despite how welcoming it is when you're there, as a tourist or as a visiting musician or something like that, it can feel a little alienating to move to a place where you're sort of constantly and subtly reminded that you're from away, and that doesn't go away. And PEI, there's a bit of that too, but it's slightly tempered by the fact that, especially where we live on PEI, there's such a huge seasonal population. So like so many people come for the summers here. So many people have like holiday homes and things like that. And so local residents are really kind of used to seeing new people all the time, and people that are staying kind of temporarily and then going again, or whatever. So I don't know. I mean, but I've never felt, consequently, the point is that I've never felt like I really fit in completely anywhere. This is the closest place to feeling like home now. And it's also the first time I've ever lived in the country. I've always been a large city, or at least a small city person. And I don't know why, but I mean, I guess just from growing up that way, I always assumed that that's who I was. I was a city person, and it's been really, really wonderful to discover that I think I might actually be a country person. Mm-hmm. So that's been great. And in terms of Canada, and your other question about that, about kind of place and belonging and where we choose to be, those of us who have the privilege to choose where we can be. I, from about 2007 to around 2010, I toured Canada relentlessly, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I don't know how many times, tons and tons of times. And it's just the geographic and demographic reality of Canada is that the distances are enormous, the population is tiny, and it's really, really difficult. I know some bands and some songwriters have stuck to it and made it work for them. But my aversion to touring in Canada is really first and foremost based just around my own preference for taking things a little bit easier. Even though we tour all the time, it is definitely a lot easier for us to only drive, say, 2 hours a day in the UK or other parts of Europe versus 8 or 10 hours a day. On the other hand, there's a sort of a cultural reason, I guess, why I've stopped or at least slowed down my Canadian touring. And that's just that I believe that in Canada, in most places, we do not value live music the way we should. We tell ourselves all the time, we were so self-congratulatory in Canada about how, isn't our Canadian music just the best? And Canadian art is just the best, and we're so artistic, and we're so supportive of the arts. But it's pretty hyperbolic when you see the reality is that, as you know, as a musician in Canada, your main job is often to sell drinks. And things would be so much easier if we all just worked as bartenders and we were actually just directly employed selling drinks. But, you know, I live about an hour and 15 minutes away from Charlottetown right now. And it's hard for us to get into town to go to a show because shows don't start until super late at night here, just like in St. John's. You know, the first band won't be on until 11 or 11:30. And that means we won't get back out here until like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. So we don't often go out. And that's a real, like, I mean, I think that all goes back to the fact that the priority for a venue owner, especially if the venue is primarily a bar, the priority is to keep people in there drinking for as long as possible. And it's just, we've evolved this culture over time where, like, you know, bar owners, bar managers don't often go out of their way to help musicians or to foster a space for live music because they see music as, you know, another way to get bodies through the door and drinking. And you know what? If 80s night will do that just as well, then let's have 80s night. That's the mentality. And I'm sick of it, frankly. Like, I'm tired of it. And I'm tired of seeing, you know, people that I respect and admire so much be treated like, glorified beer salespeople. I've had enough. Every once in a while, I think, like, oh, maybe it'll be different this time, and I will do a Canadian tour, and most of the time, it's exactly the same. Having said that, there are exceptions. There are wonderful exceptions, certain places across Canada that do actually go out of their way to buck the trend and try and create a space where people are coming for the music. The music is what's important, and there might be drinks, there might not be drinks, but the music is what's focused on. But I think in general, we have a culture where we prioritize going out and partying and drinking way, way more than we prioritize live music, listening to live music, going to shows. I don't want to rant too much about that. But by contrast, although it's not true across the board, I found from very early on that in Europe, there's just a lot more focus on curating and presenting music and from the audience perspective, you know, being excited about the music primarily, and people will come to a show and they'll you know, they'll be there early and they'll be ready and they'll you know, love it, and we'll have this engaged experience, all of us, and then we'll all go home, you know, and it won't turn into this like 2 o'clock in the morning hauling your stuff out amidst a bunch of stumbling you know, late night patrons. And I don't know, I mean, it's just, for me, it's just so much better to play music in a place where that's what people are there for.
You and I actually, I'm remembering that, you know, you and I are somewhat similar in that we're, you know, we're both performers and songwriters, but we've both have been involved with this question from a number of different sides because, you know, we've both also been involved with running record labels and starting music festivals and, you know, you were involved with Headless Owl Records, and you were one of the founders of Lawn Yvonnya Festival in St. John's. And part of what I'm hearing you say is that the job is actually one of, or the question is one of audience creation or education, as much as it is if we're talking about the development and the enrichment of culture, sort of one of the fundamental questions is how do we engage an audience, or how do we help teach them that this is good and fun, you know, and rewarding for all levels of participation in it, whether that is as audience or as you know, organizers or performers or whatever side of it you might look at. So right. how do we do that?
I think that people are, I'm speaking, you know, from the sort of the other perspective of someone like curating a festival or whatever. I think that people are actually ready to do that. I mean, I don't, in my experience, people don't need a lot of education or you know, don't need to be led. People want this, you know. I'm not the only one. I'm not crazy. Like, there's a lot of people out there that find live music really rewarding and a really, like, fantastic, wonderful experience. But we've just become conditioned by bar culture, basically, to behave in certain ways. And it has all kinds of detrimental effects beyond just, you know, I'm not just talking about the late nights, but, for example, at the average show in Germany or in England, depending on the band, of course, you might look out into the audience and see people, you know, we have people that are coming to our shows in their teens and people in their 60s and 70s and everyone in between. And there's no sense that that's weird. You know, like the young people don't seem to be like looking around them uncomfortably being like, oh, I feel like this is like an old person show or whatever. And likewise, like the older people don't feel out of place or uncomfortable because, you know, they're at a venue watching live music. It's just totally normal. It's such a part of the culture to go out to shows for the purpose of listening to the music and watching the show. We really don't have that in Canada, all that often or in that many places. And I think people are ready for it. I think people want it so badly. And you know, there's some evidence of that in the sort of increasing popularity of house concerts. The fact that, you know, I mean, my entire high school musical experience was shaped by going to all ages shows. And somewhere along the way, in a lot of places, that tradition seems to have died off, but it's coming back again in a lot of spots anyway. Because I think we know that we want this, you know, we want to engage with music. We want to be participants. We want to be, you know, we don't want to just be consumers. We actually want to engage, in the music that we're in love with. And yeah, I mean, I think things are going to change. I really do. I feel much more optimistic about that than I do about, you know, about the current political climate or about the state of my blueberries. But I think people don't need to be led as much as it is that we actually just need to try hard to change the structural stuff.
Okay. Yeah. No. I like that, and I appreciate that insight into it, and also I do feel like perhaps like my using the term like educate was an overstatement of you know what I meant, but. Your optimism is very fortifying, I have to say. I've had fears in the past that culture in Canada has been diminished or crippled in the sense it's been related to in a way that makes me feel like we haven't escaped the idea of Canada as being primarily existing only for resource extraction. And so
right.
we're all existing in like the work camp basically. And so the focus on anything else is small.
But right. And then, yeah. And there's the fact too, that, I mean, you are probably thinking a lot about this these days too, is that like, as a festival, director, as someone that's responsible for, you know, or at least is on the front lines of being responsible for the relative success of an event, you know, part of your job is that you need to think about what's going to bring people in. And at the same time, with a festival like Sappy Fest, you've got some pretty clear goals about, yeah, and building this sort of this engaged musical community, this engaged artistic community, even if it's a temporary one, that's what you're doing. And at the same time, now that, you know, it's been so many years, you've got sort of a legacy in a way, and I'm not sure I like that word, but to think about too. So it's complicated. If we could all just say like, yeah, I believe that people are ready for, ready and willing to experience interesting, cool art, let's put it on there. You know, you do have to think about other factors too. Like, well, you know, is there a name that's going to bring people in, that's going to get people to buy tickets? Is there at least one of those? You know, it's really complicated.
Yeah. And like, and after the, you know, this summer is Sappy Fest 13, and after, you know, 12 festivals, I see it almost not so much as like a temporary gathering, you know, artistic gathering, but it's entering the realm of being like a ritualistic gathering where a lot of the same people come back every year, both audience and performers. And so that reconvening gives it a whole nother meaning, you know. It's not the first time we've all got together, it's the 13th time we've all gotten together. And so that has meaning just from the sheer fact of repetition.
Right. Yeah. And how much do you feel like the people that are coming to Sappy Fest for the first time, or have come to Sappy Fest for the first time in the last few years, are also sort of aware of that and are participating in that ritualistic kind of element of it? Like, basically, I guess what I'm saying is, like, are the new people also creating rituals?
I hope so. And I think a lot of times, yes. Like, I think Sappy Fest is the non-hierarchical sort of arrangement of how we're all interacting. Like, we have no backstages and we have no VIP areas and that kind of thing, like, means that we are all quite literally just sharing the space together for the whole weekend. That makes it really open, I think, for people to feel like they do belong there. Like, there's no tricks, there's no, like, you need to know about this, or you don't need, you know what I mean? Or you don't have to buy a tiered ticket in any sense. You know, you are literally sitting at the same picnic table with the performer, and the performers are sitting at the same picnic table with each other, and you know, and we're all at the Legion after the show and all that kind of stuff. So I think the opportunity for a newcomer to feel involved, you know, there's fewer obstacles here than there is at a lot of similar things.
Right. And that ties back to what I was trying to say. I mean, you said it much more eloquently than I did, but it ties back to what I was trying to say about a lot of the problem with touring in Canada for musicians is that we're facing structural barriers that Sappy Fest never put up in the first place. And I remember that from the first time I went to Sappy, feeling like, I mean, it's a whole new wave of experiencing music as a participant, you know, as a listener, but also as someone who's, I'm meeting people, I'm meeting other musicians, I'm meeting audience members. And at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter who's who, you know, it's totally irrelevant that the person you know, you've forgotten all about the fact that the person you're sitting with is someone that you've looked up to for years, and you were really nervous to meet them, but it turns out, like, you're just having a chat, and it's really about those structural decisions to avoid creating backstage areas, VIP places, that kind of stuff. And I think that there's a lot to be said for acknowledging how much of an effect those decisions have had on the ritualistic aspect of Sappy, and what people get from it that they don't get at other festivals, mm-hmm. or their events. Yeah.
And it's similarly, like, when we're inviting artists to come, like, for the first time, the more that can be based on a direct conversation with the artist, the more that artist is going to get out of Sappy Fest. And I know that, you know, for a fact. And then, like, last year was my first year as the creative director, after being involved on the board and in various volunteer capacities previously. But, like, when I was booking Lito Pimienta to come, it involved quite lengthy conversations with Lito in the lead up. And that meant that when she arrived, she was completely ready to be here, you know?
Right.
Where if it had been booked through, like, a booking agent, then it's that much harder to get to that point with an artist. And the artist is actually like less likely to get much out of Sappy Fest. So this year, I first approached US Girls through an agent, but very quickly, to her credit, Meg, was just like, let's just talk, let's meet for a coffee and talk about how to make this happen.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, it remains to be seen, but I feel like we're really well set up for US Girls being here and it being really great experience for them and for the audience, you know?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's it exactly, is that when the artist is 100% on board and understands what it's all about, they're going to have the best time and they're going to put on the best possible show and they're going to, you know, they're going to just dive right into it all. And the audience is never going to forget that, you know, and it just creates this totally different way of doing music. I just wish more, it's so easy in a way. It's like so easy to take that mentality, to have that mentality and to take that approach. And most musicians, at least in my experience, are totally ready for that. That's what we want. And if only more music festivals could take a page out of the Sappy playbook, I think that, you know, there would be a lot more relevant music festivals.
Yeah, and you know, there is people trying to do it, and so there is, I think, reason for optimism. And
totally.
To bring it back to your, I'm usually maybe more the optimist as the host of this show. With some of the conversations I have, so I appreciate that, you know, we've switched positions a little bit today. We are sort of winding down on time here, Matthias, and I would actually like to maybe make my final question to you today, one about optimism, and on the Burning Hell album Revival Beach, which we have acknowledged is in part about apocalypse and the ends, the end times. The final song, Supermoon, is one in which many of the characters that we've been spending time with through the album they've convened or reconvened on a beach, and they are having a party, with the implication that it's you know, post-apocalyptic party they're having. And
yeah,
the final couple lines of the song refer to starting again and to everybody partying in their birthday suit. And I would love to hear you talk about ending this album on such a... Is that an optimistic note? Is that a reflection of an optimism that you feel?
I'm not sure if it's a reflection of an optimism that I actually feel a lot of the time. It's an optimism that I would love to believe in. And that song came out of a few different places. One is that I've never understood why the plethora of post-apocalyptic films and literature and art that we have produced and that we consume sort of ravenously, why so much of it, almost all of it, predicts that what's probably going to happen after the end of the world is that we're all going to eat each other or whatever, turn into zombies or something like that. But like, humans, among our short list of positive attributes, we do have an amazing ability to regenerate and to survive, and you can look at it negatively, like we're sort of on the cockroach end of the spectrum, or like parasites, you know, like we'll live on no matter what. But then there's the positive idea that maybe, just maybe, even in the bleakest times, there's a chance that things might not be 100% bad. So that's kind of one place. And then it was also a narrative decision in that I was missing all those characters. That was the last song I wrote for the record, and I felt kind of fond fondly about all of those characters, and I wanted them. I just imagined, you know, well, why couldn't they just all get together? They're all coming from different narratives that aren't necessarily even on the same timeline or whatever, but they could all get together at the end and have a little party. And then the third and final aspect of that song is that spending time, I've lived on Prince Edward Island for the last few years now, and one of the best things about this place is the amount of time that we get to spend on the beach, on various beaches, having a bonfire, looking at the stars, swimming in the water. It's wonderful. And so I guess it was sort of me imagining what would happen after the end of the world on PEI. And that's where that song went from there. So I don't know. I mean, optimism, it's a funny thing. It's something I think is worth cultivating. And I try and take time out from my usual, cynicism and pessimism to work on it. And I think we could probably all use a little bit more of it in order to do something constructive about our situation.
You're listening to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick, with my special guest today, Matthias Kalm of The Burning Hell. Matthias, thank you so much for spending this hour with us today.
And thank you so much. I'm so excited about Sappy, and I can't wait to get back to Sackville.
We can't wait to have you. Perhaps we could end with a song today.
Sure.
Is there a song from Revival Beach or anything else that we could play?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we were just talking about Supermoon, so why don't we play Supermoon's last song on Revival Beach?
Let's play Supermoon. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Supermoon by The Burning Hell.
Sorry to turn on the light. I hate to wake you in the middle of the night. But you were snoring like you were being waterboarded. And you know how I feel about torture.
Yes, I know how you feel about torture.
It's all over, though it's hard to believe it. We should pack whatever is needed and haul our affairs down the apples and pears. And make like a drummer and beat it.
I'm gonna make like a drummer.
It's coming up, a super moon. We'll dance like sailors danced back in the days when there were sailors and dancing. We'll shake like everyone's watching and we know how to move. The cha-cha-cha and the boogaloo too. Cocktail shaker, a karaoke machine. We'll bring one of each. Then meet our friends where the moonlight hits the sand. Down on Revival Beach.
Down on Revival Beach.
Kevin brought the wine from the wedding. The troll gets the glasses and pours. The patient and the nurse say, hey, it could be worse. At least we don't have to work anymore.
No one has to work anymore.
It's coming up, a super moon. We'll sing all the songs. We hardly know how to sing, but we'll sing regardless. Pass the wine. Remember, the government looks like their bill came due. But who needs a government when there's dancing to do? Coming up, a super moon. considering the chaos and upheaval. This is all much more medieval than evil. Bonfires and beaches, passionate speeches. Darren plays a little tune on the lute. Let's start again, get the juice in the gin, and put on your birthday suit.